apply that energy to my agenda? Are you willing to put your thoughts and feelings aside in order to care for mine? In essence, people want you to behave differently so they can feel better. How much you're willing to change will prove to them how much you love them. Trey was 20 years old. Jaden was 14. Willow was 12. I began to experiment with my parenting by reassessing my relationships with my children in terms of my care and concern for their feelings. I was a master provider and protector. I was a world-class teacher. But I began to be able to perceive the subtle and not so subtle emotional injuries of their childhoods. The one consolation I afforded myself was that at least I saw I was getting better. Trey had gotten the most ignorant version of my parenting. Jaden got Will Dad 2.0, which was a slight upgrade. And even though Willow had had to shave her head, she had stopped me before her point of no return. At 11 years old, Willow, for all intents and purposes, retired from the entertainment industry. I knew a part of it was the intrinsic pressure of the business, but I also knew a bigger part of it was that she had felt unprotected. She couldn't articulate it, but it was clear that she didn't want any part of anything that took my focus off of her heart. I could feel my family turning away from me, questioning my leadership and even my love. Trey asked me at dinner one night, "Dad, what do you worship?" Cherie had recently rediscovered the church. She'd found comfort and transformation in Christ. It was beautiful to watch, and it was real. And while I was happy that she had kindled a new faith and direction, I deeply resented that she began questioning and judging my choices and my decisions in my life. In the Black community, when someone discovers faith as an adult and begins to point out your transgressions and detail your only path to salvation, we call that holy rolling. And there are very few things more incensing than one of your ex-sin partners pointing out your current sins. I loved how Trey took to the Bible. He has one of the purest hearts of any human I've ever met. I was excited to discuss Abraham and Isaac and to debate the righteousness of David and what the story of Lazarus really means. I was wide open to ponder the life of Christ in the spiritual context and the historical, even the mythological, if his mind could handle it. What I was neither prepared nor willing to do was to debate the scriptural inadequacies of my life decisions. "I worship God," I said. "Are you sure?" he said. "So here's the deal, Trey. Your Bible is brand new, with pages you haven't even looked at yet. Mine is tattered and worn, with no page unturned. So why don't you rough your Bible up a little bit, then we can have this conversation in a few years." I had brushed off his question, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. I do interviews for a living. 35 years of questions and 50-something languages, and the number one greatest question that I've ever been asked is, "What do you worship?" And the second greatest question is, "Are you sure?" I decided we needed a family project. We tended to rally around one another when one of us had a significant endeavor. Trey playing football, Willow with her music, Jaden during Karate Kid, Jada or myself on a film set. There was something galvanizing when we worked together. After Earth became the project that was going to rejuvenate and reconnect us. I had seen a TV show called I Shouldn't Be Alive. It featured different stories about harrowing, life-threatening ordeals and jaw-dropping brushes with death. One of the stories was about a father and a son who had become stranded in the wilderness, miles and miles from civilization. The father was injured in an accident, and the teenage son had to travel alone through dangerous terrain to find help and save his dad. As I watched, I kept imagining myself injured and helpless, and Jaden climbing through the wilderness trying to get to civilization to save me. The scenario stuck in my mind. A coming-of-age story about a young man trying to save his father. The idea morphed into a movie. It would also be about a father learning to trust and depend on his son. It would be a metaphor, a means to healing their relationship. At the time, I was also experimenting with migrating story through time and setting. Can you take a 1940s Berlin nightclub with all of the core human themes and conflicts and set it 1,200 years in the future and maintain the fundamental human truths? I sent the episode of I Shouldn't Be Alive to M. Night Shyamalan. He felt great about the episode and thought there was a movie in it. When Knight felt the idea, I took it as providence. Knight had vowed to shoot the interiors of his films in only one city, Philadelphia. Knight lived just outside Philly. I had never worked on a film in my hometown. My immediate family and my extended family would be together for 3 whole months. My foot was on the gas. I had also just agreed to mentor Jada's brother, Caleb Pinkett, in the process of script development. He was a world-class history buff, and historians tend to have profound insight into character and story. He was a perfect pupil, and he was my brother-in-law. Family, family, family. JL hated the idea. JL hated the treatment. JL hated the timing. JL hated everything about it. It's just a concept, JL said. Finish the script, complete the story. Let's not pull the trigger until we know what we're pulling the trigger on. But I wasn't hearing it. I needed this to save my family. And then there was the secret vow, my hidden agenda. I was going to make sure that Jaden felt loved, protected, and cared for every step through the process. He was going to know unequivocally that his father cares about his feelings. After Earth was set 1 millennium in the future, after humankind had rendered the planet uninhabitable, father and son crash land in the most dangerous place in the universe, Earth. The interiors of the film had been shot in Philly, and the exteriors would be captured in Moab, Utah, and Costa Rica. Jaden's character, Katai, would have to make his way through jungles, rivers, plains, canyons, and volcanic streams in order to save his injured father. I was determined to create a joyful and loving environment for Jaden on set. Costa Rica was hot, slangily and temperature-wise. I had giant air-conditioned tents set up at every location so Jaden could chill between shots. Ping pong tables, food, music, somewhere he could take a nap. What the fuck is this tent shit? Daryl said, pulling me to the side. It's hot, D. I just want him to be comfortable. Comfortable? You gonna make this little nigga soft? Your character is the top general in the universe. How he supposed to save your ass coming out of a fucking tent? Let his ass wait in the sun like everybody else. Daryl had been my mentor, my coach, and confidant for a decade now. He had prodded and pounded and propelled me into my wildest dreams. He knew how to build winners. He had been there with Sugar Ray versus Marvin Hagler. He knew how to design soldiers. I'm not sure why I didn't just tell him what I was going through and what I was doing. I was probably embarrassed. Or maybe I just concluded that he wouldn't understand. But Daryl saw my actions as a form of sabotage. I was breaking all the rules that had defined our successful conquest. This drove a wedge between us that eventually grew into a chasm and ultimately estrangement. We stopped working together. At the time, I couldn't muster the courage to communicate with him directly. Our decade-long, hyper-successful partnership just ended without even a conversation. Daryl would later confide, "You broke my heart. You never even told me why." In terms of my relationship with Jaden, the filming was perfection. When I would come to set on The Karate Kid, Jaden would deflate and lose his energy. It was as if the enemy had arrived. I was the person who was going to push him, to make him do another take, to extend the movie shoot another month in China because I wasn't happy with the scene. But on After Earth, I didn't allow production to go 1 minute beyond his allotted shooting schedule. I was his protector. One day on set, in what was my highest parenting moment with Jaden, he was shooting an action sequence on one soundstage, and I was producing a shot on another. I wasn't on stage with him, but I had a monitor where I could see everything he was doing. One of the coordinators was asking him to do a move that Jaden was uncomfortable with. He tried a few times to explain that he didn't want to do it, but the man wasn't taking no for an answer. I could see on the monitor that they were in a dispute, so I turned on the sound. "That doesn't seem realistic to me," Jaden said respectfully. "Well, let's just get a few takes," the coordinator insisted. And then, the individual greatest words I've ever heard from Jaden's mouth. "Can someone go get my dad, please?" It makes me teary every time I think about it. I had transformed our relationship. I had purified his perception of me. I was no longer the ogre who was going to push him and punish him. I was the person he called for in his time of need. I can still see him standing there, confident. It was as if he knew he had a lion that would protect him. He didn't want to sic it on anybody, but he knew he could if he had to. When I grew up, I knew I had a lion, but I hated that sometimes he'd bite me. The shooting of After Earth was a magical bonding experience for Jaden and me. He was fresh into his teens. The mythological timing was perfect. I had succeeded in illustrating the depth of my care and concern. But in my preoccupation with his well-being, I had diverted my usual hyper-intensive focus away from the storytelling, the screenplay, and the overall sculpting of the film. As a result, our father and son honeymoon was short-lived. After Earth was an abysmal box office and critical failure. And what was worse was that Jaden took the hit. Fans and the press were absolutely vicious. They said and printed things about Jaden that I refused to repeat. Jaden had faithfully done everything that I'd instructed him to do. And I had coached him into the worst public mauling he'd ever experienced. We never discussed it, but I sensed he felt betrayed, misled, and he lost his trust in my leadership. Jaden likes to win, and he doesn't mind a little suffering to secure a victory. This is also an inherent parenting problem. There is no one size fits all. They all need different things. I've read enough to know that a critical stage of a boy becoming a man is the moment of individuation from his father. That instant when you realize your father is not Superman. He's a flawed human. That moment when you make the scary decision to separate from him and live and die by your own hand. Just like Daddy-O on the chessboard, as a father, it's what you hope for. But at 15 years old, When Jaden asked about being an emancipated minor, my heart shattered. He ultimately decided against it, but it sucks when you hurt your kids. Back then, I came to a troubling conclusion that questing with empathy was an oxymoron. And you could either worry about how people feel or you could win. But you had to pick one. On the night of Jada's 37th birthday, I had a vision. I saw her 40th birthday party. It was huge. It was wild. It would be the Taj Mahal of birthday parties. Something she would never forget. A public display of my love and affection that would fix everything. I planned it for 3 years. I love planning events, orchestrating spectacle and emotion. In my mind, the sum total of a happy life is the quality of your memories. So I'm always looking for the most vivid memory that I can create. Growing up, Jada had been close to her grandmother who had passed a few years earlier. Secretly, I contacted Jada's Aunt Karen, who was the default family archivist. Karen had pictures, videos, and letters from Jada's grandmother, and she had recently discovered microcassettes on which Jada's grandmother had recorded her thoughts during the final weeks of her life. No one in the family had heard these tapes. They would be the centerpiece of my birthday presentation to Jada. The vision was ablaze. I would do a documentary short film about Jada's life. I hired a production team to research her family's genealogy, tracking her grandmother's lineage all the way back to slavery. Then I hired a director to compile the information and make the film. But the film by itself wouldn't be Taj Mahal enough. Jada loved Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the art scene there. It would be a surprise 3-day birthday weekend. I shut down an entire hotel in the city, invited dozens of our closest friends and family. We'd have gourmet dinners each night under the stars, followed by a surprise event. Friday night would be a private art show. Saturday morning would be a spiritual pilgrimage, a hike to Picacho Peak. I got Jada's favorite painters to come and do custom paintings and family classes. Mary J. Blige loved Jada and agreed to give a surprise performance on Saturday night. And the crown of the weekend would be the unveiling of the documentary about her life. This was going to be my big triumph, how I would win my way back into my wife's heart. That first evening was blissful, an intimate candlelit dinner on an outdoor rustic terrace. There were maybe 20 of us. I wanted it to be small enough for Jada, but big enough for me. A cellist played as we dined. The mood was calm and loving. Everyone recounted their favorite Jada stories. Everything went perfectly. Friday night set the stage. Now Saturday was going to bring the house down. Saturday morning, the rest of the guests arrived. I had multiple activities planned, golf, hiking, brunch, spa treatments. I wanted everybody to have the freedom to move around as they pleased until the sun set, and then it was my time to shine. Dinner was at 6 p.m. There were 40 of us now. The dinner went off without a hitch. Everybody remarked on how beautiful the decor was, how delicious the food had been. I even overheard some of the women teasing their husbands. When I turn 40, you better plan me a will party. Well, you blew my 40th, but if I decide to stay with you, you make sure my 50th is like this. I wonder if Will and Jada need a wife. I was the perfect husband. And they didn't even realize I was just getting started. The dinner had been more than anyone could have asked for. An exquisite show of love that Emperor Shah Jahan himself would have approved of. And just before dessert, I gently began tapping my spoon on my wine glass. I had seen that in the movies, but I'd never done it in real life. It works. Well, first, I'd like to thank you all for coming to celebrate 40 years of Jada. If you will now all follow me, we will be having our dessert in the garden. I ceremoniously led the way. A 20-yard-long flowered archway had been hidden from view for the entire dinner. The reveal drew oohs and ahs from the crowd. The inside of the archway was lined with photos of Jada, a gallery in celebration of her power, her beauty, and her contribution to all of our lives. Perfect lighting, illuminating not only the pictures, but also the quality and abundance of my love. The far end of the archway spilled into an open-air theater. Again, the crowd reacts in awe. Jada seemed to be enjoying herself, but she was quiet. I couldn't get a good read. But it didn't matter, because I knew the documentary would be a hands-down grand slam emotional home run. I escorted Jada to her front row seat. Gammy hadn't seen or heard any of this footage of her mother either, so I sat her right next to Jada. The rest of the guests scrambled to get the best possible seats. They could feel something special was about to happen. I had traced Jada's family lineage back to slavery. I'd found pictures and stories of Union Army war heroes, Black Wall Street business people, enslaved people, doctors, artists, all of whom had been her ancestors. I had secretly flown with Jaden to the church in Jamaica where her great-grandparents had met and married. The comedic high point of the film was a meeting between me, Jaden, Jada's brother Caleb, and a descendant of the family who had owned Jada's family during slavery. So imagine you're a sweet 67-year-old accountant from a tiny suburb outside Cleveland, Ohio. It's a normal Wednesday in your normal life. You're watching a little Jeopardy with your loving wife. You've just complimented her on her pot roast. There's a knock at the door, and there stands Will Smith and the Karate Kid. And the Karate Kid's uncle, and a camera crew. The man and his wife were great sports. He just so happened to be his family's historian. He knew the stories and the names of the people we were talking about. He showed us pictures and paraphernalia, and we ultimately got him to formally apologize on camera. "Happy birthday, Jada," he said. "Sorry for the misunderstanding." The audience was roaring. People could not believe the lengths I'd gone to. I heard folks saying, "Will is a damn fool," and "I've never seen anything like this," and "What the hell is he going to do next year?" I still wasn't finished. The room goes silent as Jada's beloved grandmother begins to speak. The recordings have been directed to specific family members, many of whom were in the crowd. For the first time since her passing, Jada was hearing the voice of her grandmother speaking directly to her. I had seen the video 100 times at this point, so I was only watching Jada. The entire place is in tears. Her family, my family, everybody. All except Jada. She sat motionless, refusing to even make eye contact with me. The video ends. Family and friends erupt in a standing ovation. Then the screen rises, revealing Mary J. Blige. We went back to the hotel room. Jada still hadn't said anything. Not a thank you, not an I loved it, nothing. She took a shower. I was sitting there, waiting. After about 30 minutes, Jada emerged from the bathroom. "I don't want to do anything tomorrow," she said, "so you can cancel whatever you had planned." I was dumbfounded. Okay, I said, stifling my growing disappointment. "It's late. We'll just wait until tomorrow and see how you feel." The next day, I had scheduled a group painting lesson with one of her favorite painters, Bethame Schwartz, who I had flown in specifically for this event. "I'm telling you now how I feel. I don't want to do it," Jada said.
Well, you don't know what it is, so you can't know if you want to do it or not. It's my birthday. Just cancel it, Jada snapped. I'll cancel it in the morning. Just go to sleep and see how you feel. I snapped back. Cancel it now, Jada shrieked. What the hell is your problem? I asked. That was the most disgusting display of ego I have ever seen in my life, she said. Ego. Ego? You know what? You are the most ungrateful mother... I ain't never doing shit for you ever again. Ever. Good. I don't want shit from you anyway. At this point, we're both screaming at the top of our lungs, which was very uncharacteristic. We had struggled to transcend the verbal killing fields of our childhood homes. This night was unlike any before or since. The pressure cooker of our perfect picture was cracking. We were so heated that we forgot we were sharing the hotel suite with Willow. There was a tiny loft above our bedroom. Willow had been listening the whole time. Willow slowly emerged, frightened, shaking, crying, both hands clutching her ears. Just stop! Just stop! Stop! Please stop! This was the worst I've ever felt as a parent. I immediately calmed down and moved to comfort Willow. She recoiled, refusing to let me touch her. Just figure it out! Both of you, please, just figure it out! With that, Willow left and went to sleep with Jaden. Jaden and I didn't speak anymore in Santa Fe. We didn't speak on the flight back to Los Angeles. We didn't speak for a few days after we got home. Our marriage wasn't working. We could no longer pretend. We were both miserable, and clearly something had to change. I retire, I said. I retire from trying to make you happy. You are free. You need to go make yourself happy and prove to me that it's even possible. But I quit. You go do you, and I'm gonna go do me. Jada and I were suffering the brutal death of our romantic fantasies. The burning away of the idealistic illusion of the perfect marriage and the perfect family. Neither of us wanted a divorce. We knew we loved each other, and some aspects of our union were magical. But the structure of the life we had established was strangling both of us. We'd gotten married in our 20s. We were now in our 40s. Our unhealed inner children were choking the shit out of each other. And that had to stop. We both had work to do, and we agreed that this phase would not be together. The painful awakening was to the reality that we were two separate people on two independent, individual journeys. We had simply chosen to walk this portion together. We cried like crazy, hugged, and agreed to let each other go. Give your hearts, but not into each other's keeping. For only the hand of life can contain your hearts. And stand together, yet not too near together. For the pillars of the temple stand apart. Jada sent me this quote from Khalil Gibran and repeated it over and over. What's true will remain. We had concluded that no one can make a person happy. You can make a person smile. You can compose a moment that helps a person to feel good. You can deliver a joke that makes a person laugh. You can create an environment where a person feels safe. We can and must be helpful and kind and loving. But whether a person is happy or not is utterly out of your control. Every person must wage a solitary internal war for their own contentment. We agreed that Jada's happiness had to be her responsibility,
and my happiness had to be my responsibility. We were going to seek our distinct innermost personal joys, and then we were going to return and present ourselves to the relationship and to each other already happy, not coming to each other begging with empty cups, demanding the other person fulfill our needs. We felt that this vampiric relational model was unfair, unrealistic, destructive, even abusive. To place the responsibility for your happiness on anybody other than yourself is a recipe for misery. Chapter 19, Retreat. I had achieved everything I'd ever dreamed. Career, family, business, health, megastardom, a house with a name. In fact, it was better than I had dreamed it. More money, more fame, more property, more successes. And I did everything the right way. I had reached the mountaintop, then discovered that the clouds had hidden an even higher peak. And then I scaled that one. Short of raising jokers from the dead, what else do y'all want me to do? I did it as big and as bold and as brightly as anyone had ever done it or probably ever will do it. What the fuck is everybody so upset about? How is it even possible that my life is falling apart again? What am I missing? Is it just me? Or does everybody who's gone through a breakup or difficult times during a relationship call their exes? I guess it somehow brings relief to talk to somebody who hates you less than they used to. They've processed their disappointment and disgust, refracted it through distance and time, subtracted the 12 to 15% they now see was their fault. It's actually closer to 50%. Resulting in the good times being bronzed in their memories and a pleasant nostalgic twinge when your number pops up on their caller ID. And not to forget, they hate their current man now, so you don't look so bad. Tanya had moved to Trinidad after we broke up. She wanted out of LA. Too much noise, too much history, probably even too much will. But we stayed on good terms. I had helped her move. I hadn't seen her in a few years. She was married now, with two beautiful little island-toasted babies, Marley and Sakai. On the phone, her voice sounded different. Beach life kind of different. A sun-sweetened softness, a calmness, a transformation all the way to her name. She now went by Tayana. Ty for short, an outward gesture of maintaining the essence of who she was while signaling a purging of past poisons. Ty and her family were back in LA for the Thanksgiving holiday. You have to meet Scotty, Ty said. I'm telling you, y'all would vibe. She had been saying this to me for years. Her husband, Scotty Sardina, was an artist from Trinidad and Tobago. A far cry from the executives, Lakers, and rappers turned actors she was used to dealing with. Scotty was different. Oh, and she didn't hate him yet. In fact, quite the opposite. I'd been hearing about him and the beauty of Trinidad from mutual friends whom Ty had been hosting in her new island haven. Queen Latifah had just come back, and she was raving. Queen has exquisite tastes and is very particular about her accommodations. So when she says some place is hot, you know it's hot. I need to borrow your husband, I said. I'm not sure why I said it like that. I think I may be a drama queen. I love the shock value and the amusing bullshittery of tattooing a sentence on someone's memory. I think it also breaks the ice for me. If I land it right, it's so shocking that it takes away the shock of the shocking shit I just said. Well, damn, Ty said. How long you need him?
And more importantly, what you gonna use them for? We always laughed easy. I've never been to Trinidad, I said. Queen said it's hot. Oh, that's perfect, Ty said excitedly. I could tell she was already seeing the beach parties and art exhibits they were going to take me to. We're going next month for Christmas, she said. I want them to take me tomorrow, I said firmly. I got to get out of L.A. Well, damn, nigga, tomorrow is Thanksgiving. Ty's known me long enough to know when something's going on with me. And she's loved me long enough to want to help. I mean, shit, y'all can eat. I mean, we'll leave after dinner, I said reassuringly. I can't go tomorrow, Ty said. I just want to go with Scotty. Beep, beep, beep. Hello? Scotty Sardina had never been on a private plane before. And it had been almost 15 years since I went anywhere without security. Yeah, man, he says in his easy Caribbean accent. Dreadlocks tied back behind his head. No problem, man. This my island. I know plenty people there. Trust me, everything will be cool. Don't study it. Scotty was definitely not the type of guy I was used to hanging out with. He was laid back and comfortable with just letting things happen around him. I was used to wrestling and bending the universe to my will through sheer discipline and exertion. Scotty seemed pleased to let the universe bend whichever way it wanted and then sit back, inhale, and laugh about it. I'll show you a true Trini experience, Scotty said somewhere over the Gulf of Mexico. It had been decades since I had gone anywhere without the place being prepped and brief. Are you sure it's going to be okay when we land? I mean, I'm kind of famous, I said. No way, man. I'm telling you, Trinis are cool people, most laid-back time of your life. They don't really study people. They're not even going to care that you're Will Smith. It's going to be fine, trust me. We landed at Piarco International Airport in Trinidad around 2 p.m. Bedlam ensued. The entire airport staff was on the tarmac. Airport security surrounds me and escorts us to a private room. Scotty is in shock. He's never seen anything like this in his life.
I don't know why they're getting on like this, man. They come like never see come see. It's just unruly.
Scotty takes out his cell phone to contact his friend Jason, who was picking us up. Scotty didn't know any of the movie star rules, particularly Rule 4A, Section 2. Plan ahead for all departures and arrivals. It's difficult to move film stars through crowds. Note, you should call your friend who's picking you and the movie star up before you land at the airport.
Jason, nah, man, nah,
Scotty yelled into the cell phone.
I told you we was on the way. No, Jason, I meant on the plane. I call you from the plane. Come now, man. It was a personal private plane. Where you, man? How far you reach? Jason, no! That's too long. Drive faster than that.
The center of Scotty's charm is he doesn't see people as somebodies and nobodies. Everybody's somebody. I couldn't remember the last time I had carried my own luggage. As prosaic as that might sound, no security, no assistance in a foreign country, for me, was an intimidating, epic adventure. 40 minutes later, airport security escorted us to Jason's SUV. We got safely into the car and off to Scotty's childhood home. I wasn't sure what I was seeking, but I had told him no hotels, no car services, no formal plans. I wanted to be in his life, in his house, with his friends, doing whatever they would ordinarily do if the Fresh Prince wasn't here. One of his childhood friends, Che Lovelace, was a 43-year-old painter from a prominent Trini arts family. He had an exhibit that night. We dropped our gear at Scotty's mom's house and rolled over to Che's show at the Aquarella Galleries. Scotty was driving.
You just relax and make yourself at home, man, Scotty said. My crew won't even give you no trouble. Everybody here will be respectful of your space.
I don't know, Scotty, I said. I mean, I've never been here before, but we may want to be prepared for, you know, maybe people being excited.
No, man, not here. Different scene. These are my folks, and they're not on all of that. My people are not like that.
We arrived at the art show. Two steps out of the car, and it was a massive, chaotic mob scene. A couple hundred people cheering, pushing, grabbing, screaming. It was all love, but as the saying goes, sometimes love hurts. Excited crowds can be dangerous. Scotty is now in full security mode, trying to get me through the electrified crowd of his folks. It was the first time that I had ever had security who was wearing flip-flops. It was also the first time since I had become famous that I didn't have backup. No security, no one to call. I didn't know where I was, where the exits were, where the U.S. Embassy was, nothing. It even felt like I didn't speak the language. It's what a baby must feel like being expelled from the safety of the womb. I was a 42-year-old newborn. We make our way through the gallery, safe now in the artist VIP. I meet Che and his family, his younger sister, Asha Lulu Lovelace, Che's son, Roscoe, and Lulu's daughters, Ela and Eva. There's something about the Trini son that bakes children to perfection. These were the most beautiful kids you can imagine. Che is a figurative artist. His work mixes realism with abstraction. He typically paints figures from the local carnival on board using pastel paints and powdered pigments, vividly capturing the vibrancy of Caribbean life. I got lost in the eyes of his depiction of a young woman in a painting he called Dance Hall Queen. I felt her welcoming me to the island. The exhibition was well attended, and the varied cross-section of Trinidad's melting pot was a canvas in itself. Eventually, we headed back to the Lovelace family home. A covered porch, music, food, conversation, nestled in a lush area known as Cascade. The home's green exterior caused the house to almost disappear into the surrounding forestry. The Lyman, the Trini word for hanging out, partying, happened on the covered wooden veranda, which was open on three sides to the sloping garden and the Cascade Valley. There was a dining table, Morris chairs, and my favorite spot, the standard Trini hammock. The Lovelace family is a family of artists, poets, intellectuals. Earl Lovelace, the patriarch, is a renowned novelist, journalist, playwright, and poet. Lulu is a professor of cinema at the University of the West Indies. Walt, the older brother, is a cinematographer. The house itself was filled with Che's artwork. The conversation was vibrant and expansive. "What is that sweet scent?" I asked. "That's called the Lang Lang tree," Lulu said. "It's best this time of year when the breeze comes in off the west." I had never heard any of the music of Lulu's playlist. Senegalese singers Ishmaelo, Baba Mal, and Youssou N'Dour, all harmonizing with the Lang Lang tree, transporting me into a sweet wistfulness. "Are you spending the night?" Ela asked in her six-year-old innocence. I laughed that adult laugh that adults laugh when they're not really laughing. "Well, Ela, apart from one night in the Lincoln bedroom after Bill Clinton's inauguration, I haven't stayed over at anyone's house since I was 12 years old. I don't even stay at my parents' spots when I go back to Philly.
I know you're only 6, Ela, but you need to understand that there are significant logistical difficulties to safely transporting a global icon around the world. For starters, I travel with a minimum of 10 people, meaning we need a minimum of 11 rooms. And if it's at all possible, for security purposes, my entourage will take the whole floor of the finest hotels in the world. Of course, my room is always the one all the way at the end of the hallway, the room with the double doors. Not to mention, I don't really know any of you. I barely know Scotty. I'm here alone. And I've never been alone. So the thought of staying over with strangers, even strangers as kind and as beautiful as your family, scares the living daylights out of me. So yes, Ela. Yes, I'm spending the night. So where's my room? I asked. My room was nicknamed the dungeon. It was a storage area with a garage vibe that had been converted into a guest room. Books, old vinyl records, and pottery were strewn about. The only piece of furniture was a handcrafted wooden platform bed that I would later find out Scotty had made. A white sheet billowed over the wrought iron glassless window. The 80-degree Caribbean nights left no need for anything else. My luggage was still at Scotty's mom's house. "I'll come true tomorrow with it," Scotty said as he drove away, leaving the biggest movie star in the world with no toothbrush at a stranger's house. When I agreed to stay, I thought it was clear that I was agreeing for me and Scotty. I cannot believe this joker left me here. Charlie Mack is going to shove Scotty's head in the toilet when he finds out. I always know my direction. It was a daddy-o prerequisite. At any moment during my childhood, he would ask, "Which way is north?" or "Point east." He had made it very clear that the passenger in any vehicle is the navigator. The driver gets the last word on the radio and the temperature. The passenger slash navigator is in charge of the map and the call on left or right. And snacks. We would have to feed Daddy-O while he was driving. This night, though, I couldn't see the moon. And I had been distracted during the drive to the house. I wasn't really up on my star constellations. As I lay 12 inches off a concrete floor somewhere in the Caribbean, I began to chuckle, my lifelong reaction to trauma and anxiety. My chuckle upgraded to a giggle. My giggle escalated into a guffaw, and my guffaw bloomed into full-on hysterics. Where am I? What am I doing? What is going on? How did my life get here? I don't even know where here is. Nobody I love knows where I am. This would be the perfect time for somebody to kill me. I mean, not that anybody would want to kill me. I mean, Wild Wild West wasn't that bad. What if a woman walked in right now? What if she was wearing a long white see-through nightgown? What if she put her finger to her lips? Shh. What if she kissed me? What if she told me I was on the right path? What if I believed her? I slept for about 12 hours. I went to sleep at 42 years old. When I woke up, I felt like I was about 28. I would have slept longer, but the aroma of the tomato choca, smoked herring, sada roti, homemade bread, and local fruits I didn't even recognize hit me like a dose of sweet smelling salts. After I embarrassed myself by eating 3 platefuls and finishing off Ela's half-eaten bread, Scotty finally pulled up. Still no toothbrush. "My boy Jonathan has a Bertram yacht," Scotty announced. "We're looking to go DDA." The entire Lovelace family oohs and claps. Clearly, DDI is something good. "What's DDI?" I ask. "Down the islands." We set sail at about 9 a.m. me, Scotty, Che, Lulu, Roscoe, Ela, Eva, and Jonathan. After about 40 minutes, we tucked into a secluded cove off Shaka Shikari Island. Scotty, Che, and Jonathan are in the water before the anchor hits the sea floor. I was trying to stay awake, but either the soothing sway of the Bertram or my gluttonous assault on Ela's leftovers sent me back into the land of Nod. 2 hours later, I awake to find the boat empty. Everybody's in the water now, except Roscoe, Che's 5-year-old son. He's eating a ripe mango, or more accurately, it looks like he's wearing it, or it's eating him. He is drenched in the flesh and the juice. I yell to Scotty and crew, "Yo! Yo, what's the plan?"
"What you mean, man?"
"I'm saying the plan for today. What we doing?"
"We here,"
Scotty said, gesturing to the horizon. "No, but, like, what are we doing?" They all kind of look at one another. What does he mean? "I'm saying, y'all got some jet skis or something?" I said, "Like, you know, like, what's around here? Like, what are we getting into?"
"Look around, man," Scotty called from the water. "We reconnecting and Lyman."
What the fuck is reconnecting and Lyman? Roscoe and his mango had been watching the whole exchange. I went back inside, lay down on the couch, closed my eyes for another 30 minutes. These jokers are really about to sit around and do nothing all day. I was dying. There was no service on my phone, so no texts or calls. We were an hour from land and 90 minutes from an airport. I was trapped. I felt like a caged animal. I was getting angry. How dare they waste my valuable time like this? I stand up and head back out on deck. They're still in the same spots, just floating and yapping. I couldn't understand what they were doing. I was jittery, I was pacing, checking the time on my phone, and then I caught myself. I noticed the turbulence of my thoughts and feelings, which stood in stark contradistinction to my surroundings. And I thought, oh shit, this is crackhead behavior. I could not sit still. My mind was agitated. I needed an activity, a target, a mission, an adventure, something, anything to do. I caught eyes with Roscoe, peering over the curvature of yet another mango. This one's bigger than his head. He was just looking at me sweetly, as if to say, "You know you look crazy, right?" It all slowly drifted into focus. Am I an addict? I don't do drugs. I don't really drink. I'm not hooked on sex. But I did not know how to stop or be still or be quiet or alone. I'm addicted to the approval of others. And to secure their approval, I became addicted to winning. And to guarantee and sustain my stream of massive victories, I became addicted to working, to grinding, and obsessively pursuing perfection. But there was a deeper issue at play. I saw downtime as the enemy, a place where you lose things. When I had left space between Melanie and me, she had cheated. Daddy-O saw the space between tasks at the shop as laziness. Daryl never wanted me to sit down in the gym. He saw downtime as the crack where the pleasure principle would poison all our hard work. I never wanted Jeff to put interludes on our albums because I saw the lull between tracks as the empty space for the audience to stop listening. I didn't want to leave space between my TV show and the next movie and my next record because I didn't want to give people an opportunity to fall in love with The Rock during my absence. But the most perturbing aspect of my need to feel every second was that it kept me from having to feel. My mind drifted to my I Am Legend call with JL. The film had broken global box office records, but still I was dissatisfied. The subtle sickness was becoming a whole lot less subtle. I asked myself, how much did I Am Legend need to make for me to be happy? How much would have been enough? How many consecutive number one movies do I need? How much money would it take for me to feel safe and secure? How many Grammys or Academy Awards do I need to feel loved and approved of? How much healthier do my kids need to be? How many more times does Jada need to say, I love you? When will enough be enough? The problem is, the more you get, the more you want. It's like drinking salt water to quench your thirst. We develop a tolerance that makes us need more just to get the same high. I started to recognize the game, the trick, the insanity, the carrot on the stick. I had never liked vampire movies, but I suddenly understood their mythology. They are a metaphor for insatiable human hunger, unquenchable thirst, and chronic dissatisfaction. The attempt to fill a spiritual hole with external things. If unparalleled winning and achieving everything I've ever dreamed of doesn't secure perfect happiness and ultimate bliss, then what does? I looked at Roscoe. As far as he was concerned, the key to life was mango.
Come on in, the water warm, Lulu said. I don't know how to swim, I responded. Clearly, they had never heard an actual human say that before. First they laughed, then came the realization that I wasn't joking. And then they all looked at me like I was starring in a UNICEF commercial.
Please help this stereotypical Afro-American urban homeboy. Just $1 a week will help this joker learn how to swim. I had always feared the ocean. It seemed so vast and unpredictable. It could be calm and beautiful one minute and then violent and monstrous the next. Even as a child, I stayed far from the water on family trips to Atlantic City. I remember being at the Grand Canyon and my mom saying, this entire canyon was created by water. That was a terrifying proposition to me. The ocean and water, we just don't vibe. One of my most traumatic childhood memories was of nearly drowning in a public swimming pool. I can still see myself underwater, disoriented. I couldn't figure out which way was up. I'm choking and I know I'm dying. My mom leaps from her deck chair and dives into the pool. I can see her hand coming towards my face. She grabs me under my arms and lifts me out of the pool onto the side. Years later, as I recount to one of my mom's friends my harrowing brush with death, my mom's face contorts into confusion. She's trying to read me. We've been here many times, but she can tell something's different. You know that never happened, right? My mom gently asks.
What do you mean? I say.
Willard, that never happened, she says a little more urgently. I remember the whole thing, Mom, I say. You never got into a pool. You never got in the ocean. We sent you to swimming class once, and you wouldn't even put your feet in the water.
But, Mom, I can see it all. You had an afro, and you were wearing a blue bathing suit.
Well, it must be your other mother, because this one never had that experience. I begin to forensically examine my memory, and then it hits me. If I was under the water, disoriented, how did I see my mom jump into the pool? Then my cinematic experience kicks in. I realize that the angles of my visual recollection are not from my point of view. In my mind's eye, I'm seeing the incident as if I were on the side of the pool. The two-shot of me and my mom in my mind is impossible. This is a false memory. But all of my anxiety about the ocean, my fear and aversion to water is 100% real. This revelation shook me. Is my memory that unreliable? Did I dream it? Did I make it up? Is it a past life experience? If it was, what the hell was my mom doing there? And why did she have an afro? Either way, it didn't really matter. I still hated the ocean. Memory is not a flawless recording of what actually happened. It's not a video of your experience. It's not even a photograph. It is your psychological, artistic rendering. It's more like an abstract, impressionistic painting of what happened than it is a pure, unfiltered depiction. And it's not fixed. The painting morphs. It fades or expands over time. Sometimes you add colors to a memory that weren't there a year ago or 5 years ago, or even collapse multiple memories and paint them into one. The problem is that most of us trust our memories implicitly. Our memories are the basis for our perception of reality. We then commit to these conclusions, unlocking the requisite emotions and the corresponding actions and behaviors. We move into the world clinging to our flawed assumptions, unleashing upon ourselves the cosmic consequences of wrong ideas. I trust the memory that I nearly drowned. In fact, I'm fully committed to the truth of that story. Water is dangerous, and it tried to kill me when I was little. So when my brother and sisters are playing in the ocean, I'm by myself halfway up the beach. As an adult, I don't let my kids go in the ocean by themselves. The fear and anxiety take hold in my mind and then constrict my ability to be able to enjoy the beauty of 70% of the Earth's surface. Just relax, bro. I'm barely 10 yards from the shore, but the sea is choppy. The water is up to my waist. As Scotty sits down, the water is up to his neck. Take a dip and chill, he says. It won't go over your head. Yo, man, hey, shit is touching my legs, I say. Seaweed, man. Sargassum. It's a problem we're working on. Just come in. Scotty reaches down and grabs a handful of whatever sargassum is and slings it away from me. Apparently, the fact that it's now 8 feet away is supposed to make me comfortable. I take a deep breath, and I sit. The sea is almost translucent and as warm as bathwater. The waves are knocking and jolting and tossing me around. Don't fight it, man, Scotty says. It's a flow. It'll carry you out, but it'll bring you right back. Scotty is calmly floating in complete harmony with the rhythm of the sea. And I'm banging around like a monkey fucking a football. And while I never got fully comfortable, I began to understand the human relationship with the ocean. Reconnecting in Lyman. The ebb and flow of the tide is the heartbeat of the planet. When they sit in the ocean all day, they're tuning themselves into the frequency of the earth. This alignment to Scotty was the highest human experience. When he spends time with anyone he loves, he wants to spend it in the ocean, surfing, fishing, boating, water skiing, swimming, reconnecting, and liming. When I left Trinidad, I was clear about one thing. I knew I was missing something. Something about life, something about relationships, maybe even something about me. I just didn't know what it was. But I was no longer fully defending my old belief systems. I was open to the idea that maybe fight camp mentality in the domestic realm isn't quite the optimal relating paradigm. I didn't yet know what the new ideas were, but I was certain there would have to be some. Why are you so afraid of silence? Silence is the root of everything. If you spiral into its void, 100 voices will thunder messages you long to hear. Rumi. I hate it when people send me Instagram quotes that are supposed to be deep. They always come with a little fancy border, and the background's always mauve, and in some woke-ass, illegible calligraphy font. And when they truly want to get you, they add a picture of a really, really old Asian man. You know, that's supposed to make the shit true. Silence is the root of everything. Made absolutely no sense to me whatsoever. I make noise for a living. I was so confused, I texted back, "What the fuck?" with 13 question marks. My phone rang immediately. It was my boy Antoine. He was cracking up. "Man, don't be sending me your little pseudo-inspirational Buddha babble," I said. "If you're going to send me quotes, you're supposed to be sending me lyrics from Talib Kweli." "I just got back from India," he said, cracking up, knowing he had no business sending me that Rumi bullshit. "That is no excuse," I said. "Hey, what were you doing in India?" "Man, I did this thing called Vipassana. It's a 10-day silent retreat. No television, no phone, no talking. It was wild. You have to do it. No talking for 10 days. You did that. Wait, what's it called again? Vipassana. It means to see things as they really are. Antoine and I hadn't spoken in over a year, but I guess he just needed somebody to talk to. It's weird how people can feel when you're seeking. Higher curiosity seems to emit energy at a different frequency. As soon as you truly open to something different, it's like a cosmic shout into an energetic megaphone. "Yo, where y'all at? Y'all see I'm struggling over here." "Yeah, man, I'm not sure I'm ready for India," I said, "but I do like the idea of seeing things as they really are." My entire childhood, I shared a bedroom with Harry. If you drew a timeline that stretched from the day I met Melanie when I was 14 all the way to my marriage today, I have only been single for a total of 15 days. I hated being alone. I wanted to give Jada her space in LA, so I decided to spend a couple of weeks alone, just I, myself, and me. I wanted to see if the three of us could get along. No television, no phone, no people, no talking. I went to our Utah house in the mountains, totally secluded, 8,400 foot altitude. I'd organized to have food left at the door, but no human contact. Other than a solitary morning walk, I wasn't going to leave the house for 14 straight days. Antoine had only done 10 days, so I had to beat him. Day one was exciting. No texts, no email, no calls. I was preparing my own meals for the first time in 30 years. They were nasty, but I felt good about the attempt. No television or computers other than my iPad, which I'd filled with books to read. This was the first time in my life I had ever read a whole book in one day. Pema Chodron's When Things Fall Apart. Day two and three each felt like they were about 39 hours long, which would have been almost bearable if it weren't for the incessant chatter of the entourage in my head. Days four and five almost broke me. I was crawling up the walls. I was even thinking about taking sleeping aids during the day so I could get some relief. I just somehow knew NyQuil wasn't an approved Vipassana substance. I had committed to myself that I would do 14 days. And I'd learned a long time ago, I might break my promise to you, but I'll never break my promise to me. Day six, I caught myself in the mirror with a pair of tweezers plucking my eyebrows. I knew I was in trouble. By day 7, I had beautifully sculpted eyebrows, and I discovered that there's a name for this condition, trichotillomania, aka hair pulling disorder. I knew I didn't have it, but there was always day 8. Day 8. That's it. I gotta call somebody. Shit, nope. Nope, I'm not gonna do that. Why do I feel like I wanna cry? Vipassana is fucking stupid. Wait, what time did I start? Wait, am I counting a day from midnight or from the exact hour I started? So is this day 8 or 9? Antoine's a fucking moron. So is Rumi. By day 9, I noticed that my dreams were becoming more vivid and creative ideas were flowing. I started filling up notebook after notebook with rhymes and songs and thoughts and opinions and movies and poetry. I started reading about meditation and became intrigued with the idea of watching my mind. It was my introduction to words like self-observation, self-investigation, consciousness, and awareness. I tasted a tiny, fleeting moment of what I would later come to recognize as peace. It didn't last too long, but it was a scent that I would learn to follow. This time in Utah launched the greatest period of reading in my life, a period that would last for the next several years. As a very partial list, I devoured The Autobiography of Malcolm X, Bhagavad Gita as it is, The Road Less Traveled, Don Quixote, The Untethered Soul, Teachings of the Buddha, The Odyssey, Moby Dick, How to Win Friends and Influence People, The Five Love Languages, As a Man Thinketh, Oneness, Zen and the Art of Archery, Plato's Republic, The Way of the Superior Man, Iron John, Aspire, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, The Power Path, Man's Search for Meaning, and on and on and on. I must have read at least 100 books over the next few years. Day 10 was the first time I tried to meditate. Day 11, I gave up meditation. It literally felt like my mind was attacking me. Day 12, I gave meditation another shot. I read Chodron's How to Meditate, A Practical Guide to Making Friends with Your Mind. I like making friends, I thought. I began trying to listen to and observe what was going on in my head. And a painful realization washed across me. I wasn't enjoying being with myself. In fact, I wanted to get away from myself as fast as I could. And it dawned on me, if I don't want to be with me, why the fuck would anybody else want to be with me? Chapter 20, Surrender. What would make you happy? I'm not talking about Will Smith, because he comes with a lot of baggage. But you, if you could be master of the universe and you could snap your fingers and have any life you wanted, what would it look like? That was a really heavy question. Michaela Baum is a single red curly hair over 5 feet tall. Her Austrian accent makes everything she says ring with psychoanalytical authenticity. She's an author, public speaker, and counselor with more than 3 decades and 35,000 client hours in the trenches. Her in-depth training in Jungian psychology, trauma, and relationship therapy is seasoned with an expertise in tantric sexuality. The Google search alone had me feeling exposed and vulnerable. So when she walked in carrying a silver-spangled Moroccan camel saddlebag with indeterminate fur, and her first question was, "What would make you happy?" I was instantly off balance. What does she mean by that? What makes her think I'm not happy? Apart from the whole K can you come help me because I'm not happy thing. To me, it was blasphemous to even imagine something other than the life I'd created. My imagination is usually a white water rapids ride of possibilities and potential. But for some reason, this question led me into an area of my inner world that had danger signs all over it, yellow police tape everywhere I looked. The answer would have to be extracted from the place where only the bad kids go, the murky, swampy, shadow regions of my psyche. I don't even let myself think from inside that neighborhood, so I'm damn sure not going to speak from there. I mean, what if I rip down all the boards and barriers and barricades, and whatever demon is in there takes over? What if I can't put it back? What if I like it being out? But I approached the dark place. I wanted to see what was in there. I ducked under the first layer of yellow tape. What is she really asking me? What life would I create if I didn't give a fuck? And then the shadow spoke. I would have a harem. The vulnerability of exposing my unprocessed, unfiltered fantasies first seized me with embarrassment, then filled me with anger, like she had tricked me. Maybe Michaela's a witch. How could she get me to reveal my filthy shadow world that fast? Michaela didn't flinch. She retrieved a journal and a pen from her multicolored enchanted satchel and said, "Okay, a harem. Interesting. So who's in it?" "What do you mean?" I said. "Who's in your harem? The women. Tell me their names." Michaela is holding her pen over her journal, awaiting my answer to her question. This is some Jedi mind trick shit. Some Jungian psychotantric embodiment voodoo. She ain't getting me with this. "Don't just sit there like you don't have an answer," Michaela said. "You know exactly who the women are. This is not the first time you've thought about this. You've played this out over and over again in your mind. What are their names?" I don't know. I mean, I don't understand why you need to know who they are. "I need to know because I'm going to run your harem," she said, as if I was supposed to know that this was an actual job people did. "Look, you are Will Effin Smith. You are one of the richest, most beloved people on earth. If you can't have the life that you want, the rest of us are screwed." "Misty Copeland," I said, calling Michaela's bluff. "She's that black ballerina." "I know who Misty Copeland is," Michaela said, as she jotted down her name. "Who else?" "Hallie," I said, stone-faced. "Let's play witch lady. What else you want?" "You know, harems are not just for sex," Michaela said. "Harems are convened for inspiration. You need a doctor, you need a painter, an architect, a couple lawyers, a musician, a poet. And not just Americans. You should be hearing multiple languages. Your harem should be made up of the most beautiful, unique, and powerful women from around the world. Your responsibility will be resources and devotion to their individual growth and blossoming. And in return, they will feed you and shower you with their feminine gifts and send you into the world full and inspired." For the next 2 hours, Michaela wrote feverishly. She took out her laptop. I guess she's a modern witch. And showed me pictures and videos and TED Talks of the most dynamic and talented women from across the globe. I'm pacing and laughing and inspired. I was dancing in the shadow zone. And somehow, the demons within me that had seemed too dark and evil to even consider didn't seem so scary in the light of Michaela's acceptance. When all was said and done, we had about 25 names. We had trip routings, global events to attend like Carnival in Rio and Holi, the Hindu festival of color in India. We had a list of people who my harem and I should meet. Michaela and I high-fived, and I agreed to start making contact with the women first thing Monday morning. I had a couple of nights to sleep on it, and by Tuesday close of business, I was out. With every hour, my enthusiasm waned. Every single harem equation in my mind kept adding up to a hellscape. If I can't figure out how to nurture and nourish one extraordinary woman, what the fuck made me think I could care for 25? I don't want a harem, I said. Of course you don't, Michaela responded. But why did you think you did? I guess I felt if I had enough women, I'd always be able to find at least one of them who liked me. As long as you're doing things for the approval of a woman, Michaela said, you will never be free. That is a descending hell. And I'll tell you, when a woman sees that she can bend you, she loses trust in you. We need you to be solid. We need your yes to be a yes and your no to be a no. As long as you are twisting and contorting and selling yourself out for the affection of others, you will always be untrustworthy. Michaela began to refer to my nice guy persona as Uncle Fluffy. He was the pleaser in me, the part of me that had to smile no matter how I was feeling, doing things I didn't want to do just to keep the peace. He wasn't allowed to be in a bad mood or have a bad day. Uncle Fluffy hated